From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Power is gradually being restored to Damascus after an attack by U.S.-backed rebels blew up a gas pipeline that provides much of the energy supplied to generators in southern Syria. The city was dark last night after the massive explosion. From Damascus, Ala Ibrahim gave this report to Press TV.
Let's speak first about the city of Damascus. Since the blackout yesterday took place at almost 8 p.m. Damascus timing, 4 hours after that, power started coming back to parts of Damascus, and other parts of Damascus have restored power this morning also. Within 48 hours, which more than 12 hours of that have already passed, they're saying they're going to restore the power, the status of the power, the electric power, to what it was before the explosion, and that is more than 70 or 75% coverage of electricity time-wise for every neighborhood here in Damascus.
The explosion came only hours after Secretary of State John Kerry had received an earful from both Saudi and Israeli government officials complaining that the U.S. wasn't doing enough to support the rebels. Today, it was Germany's turn to demand that the U.S. stop spying on its head of state. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called upon President Obama over reports that the U.S. tapped her mobile phone. The president assured Merkel that his country is not monitoring her communications. Earlier, the German government spokesperson said that Berlin had information the NSA was spying on Merkel. This was followed by Germany's foreign minister, Guido Westerwelle, summoning the U.S. ambassador for, quote, an immediate and comprehensive clarification, closed quote, according to a statement from Stefan Siebert, her spokesperson. Berlin demanded that American authorities shed light on the scale of its spying on Germany and thus finally answer questions that the government asked several months ago, according to Siebert. Merkel called Obama over the issue demanding an explanation and told him that if the information proved true, it was, quote, completely unacceptable, closed quote, and represented a, quote, grave breach of trust, closed quote. White House spokesperson Jay Carney said that Obama had assured the German leader the United States is not monitoring the communications of the chancellor. Journalist Peter Oliver is in Berlin and spoke with Russia Today.
For the White House, what we've heard is a statement saying that the United States is not and would not spy on the German Chancellor's communications. Notably, from that statement, it did not say whether they had done in the past. But if you look at the record and what's been coming out about the United States' spying program, you can see why the German Chancellor would be taking this very seriously. We've seen allegations of an extensive spying campaign taking place in Brazil. Also, allegations that over 70 million phone calls were listened to in France. So you can see exactly why she'd be wanting to look into this and why she'd be wanting to nip it in the bud. She's, as I say, called this totally unacceptable if it had taken place. What we've seen, if you look at here in Germany, we've seen mass protests on the streets against the NSA spying program. Privacy taken very seriously here in Germany. Those protests have drawn some quite large crowds. We've also seen telecommunications companies looking to try and shore things up with their own customers. Deutsche Telekom announced just recently that they would only use internal German servers for German-to-German email communications to try and cut off any kind of outside access to information that was being bandied around within Germany to try and stop or try and assure its customers that it was going to stop the NSA from getting a hold of their information. Now, we've also seen political action taken. The European Parliament has suspended the SWIFT agreement with the United States. Now, that was an agreement that would share banking data. It was supposed to try and tackle terrorism terrorism, to try and stop transfers from one bank account to another that were being used to fund terrorism around the world. Now it emerges that the NSA may have been using that to spy on European citizens' personal data, so that's been suspended. There is fallout heading the United States' way as these allegations mount up that they're watching just about everybody's every move.
Meanwhile, perhaps the solution to another problem facing the president could be solved by diverting some of the computer power being used for NSA spying to service visitors to the Obamacare website. Lawmakers from both parties expressed anger today at the performance of contractors hired to build the online insurance marketplace, still limping along after 3 weeks. Some members said they were dismayed because contractors had assured the committee on September 10th that the computer systems and the online federal marketplace were ready to enroll millions of Americans eager to buy insurance subsidized by the government. According to Cheryl Campbell, vice president of CGI Federal, the main contractor, the Federal Exchange is not a standard consumer website, but what she called a complex transaction processor that must simultaneously help millions of Americans shop for insurance and enroll in health plans. She said it must communicate instantaneously with computer systems developed by other contractors and with databases of numerous federal agencies and more than 170 insurance carriers qualified to do business in 36 states where the federal marketplace operates. For a government with computers that can gather and sort through billions of phone calls and emails from all around the world, fixing the Obamacare computer problems sounds like child's play. The ACLU called on the Justice Department today to investigate the efforts by NYPD to conduct surveillance in Muslim communities in and around New York. In a letter signed by 125 state and national organizations, the groups said the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division should open a probe into the, quote, unlawful religious profiling and suspicionless surveillance of Muslims in New York City and beyond, close quote. Citing NYPD documents and a series of investigative articles on NYPD's secret intelligence operations by the Associated Press, the ACLU said that NYPD has sent paid infiltrators into mosques, student associations, and other places to take photos, write down license plate numbers, and keep notes on people because they are Muslim. Justice Department spokesperson Dina Iverson said she could not comment because she had not seen the letter. An NYPD spokesperson said the department had no immediate comment. The letter was signed by a wide array of religious, racial justice, civil rights, and community-based organizations, including the NAACP, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and the National Network for Arab American Communities. Detroit, pensions, racism, and bankruptcy. Those who were calling the shots in the nation's once flourishing auto capital now must prove in court that Detroit is legitimately bankrupt in order to restructure its $18 billion debt. Unions and pensioners and others who fear losing public services and public assets are challenging the bankruptcy. If approved, it would be the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. Ask me. The UAW and other unions have argued that the appointment of Kevin Orr, the city's emergency manager, was unconstitutional and that the city isn't eligible for bankruptcy. If approved by U.S. Bankruptcy Court Judge Stephen Rhodes, Michigan's largest city would be free to restructure its debts and liabilities, which include the pensions of present and former city workers, and to apply for federal loans. An attorney representing Detroit yesterday claimed that without bankruptcy, almost 65 cents of every tax dollar would be swallowed up by debt and other obligations. The court case marks a crucial stage since the city publicly filed for bankruptcy in July of this year. Gaurav Malhotra, a partner at Ernst & Young LLP, testified that, even before the filing, city officials had decided to cancel payments to pension funds and default on the debt. In response, unions and pensioners have challenged the legitimacy of the filing. If the court grants the petition in bankruptcy, unions worry that the city won't pay out public pensions or health care benefits for retirees and current municipal employees, and they argue that public services will be scaled back even further. The hearing is scheduled to run until October 29th, and a ruling will not be issued until at least November 13th, according to Judge Rhodes. Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg are the longtime hosts of Building Bridges, a weekly community and labor radio report produced at Pacifica Radio's WBAI in New York. They spoke with Ross Eisenbray, Vice President for the Economic Policy Institute, Richard R.J. Esko, Senior Fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, and Al Garrett, President of Ask Me Council 25, about the implications of a bankrupt Detroit for cities and workers across the country.
Detroit's economic woes can be tracked to capital flight, governmental policies, and the results of institutional racism, not the wages and benefits of its public workers. But ignoring these bedrock realities, Michigan's Governor Schneider has appointed an emergency financial manager for the financially strapped Detroit, Kevin Orr, who has rushed into bankruptcy. His bankruptcy filing will result in the pilfering of workers' pension funds.
Bankruptcy will seriously wound pensioners, despite the fact that the unfunded portion of the pension funds are minuscule, and it is unconstitutional under Michigan's Constitution. Orr's undue attention to public worker pensions is part of a nationwide trend targeting the retirement security of working Americans, especially pensions, Social Security, and Medicare. And with us to talk about this is Ross Eisenbray, Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute, and Richard Esko, Senior Fellow at the Campaign for America's Future.
Well, one of the things that hit me about what's happening in Detroit, it kind of reminds me of what's happening in Cyprus. The depositors were bailed in, not out. They were stripped of a major portion of their deposits to recapitalize the banks. Well, in Detroit, isn't it the municipal workers who are being bailed in, stripped of a major portion of their pensions to save the banks?
This is Richard Esko. I mean, I think there are some parallels. I think that, the Cyprus case was shocking because it showed the world what international financial policymakers were capable of, and it was unprecedented to think of going after depositors' money in order to pay for bad bets by the banks. I think Detroit follows a somewhat different pattern. Morally, there's some connection, but Detroit follows the pattern of whenever there's a fiscal problem at a government institution, the answer always seems to be go after middle-class pensions, go after middle-class wages, even though these things have suffered enormous contraction for reasons well out of the control of the people being involved. In fact, although those people have already paid a large price to begin with, so in the case of Detroit, for example, you have them saying we can't afford these pensions anymore because of Detroit's financial crisis. Well, financial crisis was caused by global forces well beyond these working people's control. The bulk of Detroit's financial obligations are not pension related, and even if you break open those pension obligations, for example, and you ask yourself how did a $1.4 billion pension fund suddenly incur $2.7 billion in obligations, and you find that derivatives transactions with the banks are responsible for the difference. We don't know enough about that additional obligation, but we do know it was bank related. So I think that morally and just as a practical matter, this is not a fair thing to do for the people who gave their 30 years of work to the city of Detroit and deferred some of their compensation in pension form, and now to tell them they're not allowed to get it is extremely unjust, in my opinion.
Ross, we took the title of this piece from an article that you wrote, Detroit Pensions, Racism, and Bankruptcy, and a number of points on that in terms of white flight and also the treatment of the city by the state, and especially in terms of revenue sharing, and I guess a lot more. If you could expand on that theme and tell us what's been happening over the last 30, 40 years that brought us to this point.
Well, Detroit really is an extraordinary story, and Detroit started out as a very much majority white city, and over the course of the last 50 years, basically it lost 1.5 million white residents. They started leaving in the 50s as jobs moved out to the suburbs. All of the almost all of the new investment that the auto companies did in the Detroit area was done in the outlying suburbs and outlying communities. None of it was in Detroit. So obviously workers follow the jobs, and the white families did, and they never stopped. And at various times there were incidents like the Detroit riots in 1967 scared families, white and black, and the white families who had options left in droves. It accelerated the outflow. But finally, by the 2010 census, there were only 75,000 white families left from a base that was 1.5 million to begin with. So that story, I think, is the most important story, along with deindustrialization of the whole entire United States, and its effects on the auto industry have been very dramatic, hurting employment in Michigan and even in the surrounding Detroit communities. But that white flight, which was, I think, you know, you can't call it anything other than a racist response to a growing population of blacks in the city. As people came up from the South, as black families expanded, as they came from other northern states, the whites in Detroit refused to live in the same neighborhood as blacks, and they started leaving, and they never stopped. And I guess they probably still haven't stopped, even though it's down to 75,000 people.
And the defunding of Detroit in terms of revenue sharing from the Michigan budget, which started, I think you said, in the late 50s or 60s and continued up until the present day?
Well, when Detroit became a majority black city, which was, I think, around 1980, that was the first census where Detroit was a majority black city, its relationship to the rest of the state and to the state government changed pretty dramatically. And there was a hostility among rural legislators and legislators in other parts of the state to share revenue with Detroit. And so there was a lot of pride in Detroit. Coleman Young had an attitude that was very belligerent toward the white power structure, and they didn't get along at all. And so relationships worsened, and the state shared less and less revenue. Finally, we got to the point where John Engler, of all people, made a deal with Dennis Archer, who had been a Supreme Court justice in Michigan, a Michigan Supreme Court justice, and was then mayor. He promised to provide $333 million a year in revenue sharing to Detroit if it reduced its income tax, if it capped the income tax that the city could put on workers in the city. And so Archer made that deal, and then soon afterward the state was hit by the 2001 recession and started reneging on its promise, and that continued all throughout the Granholm administration and continues today. And I think if you add up the amount of money that the state had promised to send and didn't send to the city in revenue sharing, it would exceed the pension liabilities that they're trying to eliminate, their obligation that the emergency manager is trying to discharge in bankruptcy. The state, in a moral sense, owes more money to Detroit than the sum total of those unfunded pension liabilities.
Ross, one of the things I was wondering, is there a proposed solution that could have avoided either robbing the pensioners or scaring off the bondholders, a state-owned bank, for example, where you don't have to worry about the interest rate swaps or be beholden to the bond vigilantes? What do you think?
Oh, I'm sure that there are lots of solutions. I guess I can't say I've studied enough to propose one that would work, but I would start with the state providing a lot more revenue to the city. The state is responsible for the city. It's a subdivision of the state. I mean, you can see what the relationship is. It's the state that imposed the emergency manager. on the city. So nobody claims that Detroit is really an independent entity from the state. So I would look to the state for more revenue. I would look to the federal government to do something like a Homestead Act that would encourage people to move back into Detroit. I personally don't think that the city, with its infrastructure for 2 million people, is viable with a population of only less than 700,000 and people whose income is way below the median in the United States. It's a very poor city. Something like 35% of people in Detroit have an income below the poverty level. So Detroit probably is not sustainable without a lot of outside aid. But I think it's in the interest of everybody in the United States that Detroit survive. It's certainly in the interest of people in Michigan and the surrounding communities that Detroit survive and revive.
Ross, the attack on the pension funds in Detroit is said by the state constitution says you can't do this. It's protected
right.
by the state constitution, and
it's perfectly clear.
Right. And first of all, most of the pension fund is only a small percentage that's unfunded liabilities there.
Well, it's more like 80-some percent, but it's better than many. It's not a catastrophe.
So do you think the bankruptcy court can get around this? What's going on with that?
That's an excellent question. You know, I don't think it's been resolved whether the bankruptcy court feels that it can ignore the Michigan Constitution. What's clear is that the emergency manager is extremely hostile to the workers and their interests. He's extremely hostile to the notion that they have guaranteed pensions. You know, people who have worked 30, 35 years, who were promised these pensions and gave up salary and other benefits to get them, the thought that he can, as cavalierly as he is, just throw them into the pot and say he's going to reduce them. The average pension is like $19,000. So people are not getting rich. They're barely able, a lot of people, to survive on the pension that they have. It's unconscionable that he would ignore the Michigan Constitution and do this. And I hope that there's a remedy even after bankruptcy, even if the bankruptcy judge were to go along with this, which I hope that he won't. I would hope that there is a remedy under the Michigan Constitution for what is a violation of the Constitution on the part of the governor and the emergency manager, who are state officials. For them to ignore the Constitution and try to reduce these pensions it's illegal, it's unconscionable, and there ought to be, and I hope there is, a remedy.
Richard, one of the things that, certainly I don't see that Detroit's bankruptcy poses a systematic or systemic risk in any way to Wall Street and global financial markets, but it certainly seems to pose a systemic risk to Main Street, really, to local governments and to the contractual rights of pensioners.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that the one issue that we need to be clear about is that whatever the city manager, the emergency manager, Kevin Orr's personal motivations may be, this is very much a part of a larger picture. These emergency manager laws themselves have been encouraged by groups like ALEC, Corporate, the American Legislative Exchange, I forget the acronym now, but the Corporate Funded Group for State Legislators. It's been something they've been pushing in other states, including California, where if a city runs into fiscal difficulty, the state can overrule the elected government of that city and appoint a city manager. And in many cases, it's been a Republican governor appointing city managers for emergency managers for Democratic cities. And there is a pattern throughout the country of blaming pensions, singling out from a city's entire range of financial obligations worker pensions as being outrageous and getting the public worked up as if these were enormous killings that these workers were making, when, as Ross pointed points out, it's, you know, the average is $19,000. And by the way, some of them don't have Social Security. So I think that, you know, there's a very large and systematic pattern here. And we've seen at the same time assaults on Social Security benefits, which should be increased. But we've seen calls to cut them in various wages with the president going along and deficit commissions and so on. So I think this notion that a decent retirement is somehow American reality is really pretty central to a certain political agenda, and I tend to see what's going on in Detroit as reflecting that. First of all, to overrule the local government, then to declare, attempt to declare bankruptcy legally, and then to void the pensions and to single out the pensions without looking at some of the other causes and forces behind Detroit's difficulties. And, you know, because Detroit is an extreme case in terms of the nature of its financial difficulty, the 40,000 abandoned buildings, the rapid depopulation, because it is so shocking, it's almost the perfect shock doctrine case to pick to set a precedent for cutting pensions as they've wanted to do in Vallejo, California, or other cities around the country. So I think it's one we need to watch very carefully for precisely that reason.
Well, Detroit's bankruptcy certainly also threatens to change the rules of the municipal bond game, and already it's making it more expensive for the state's other struggling towns and school districts to borrow money and fund big infrastructure projects. We'll continue to look at this critical thing because it has tremendous implications for other cities and our own as well. We've been speaking with Ross Eisenbray, Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute, and Richard Eskow, Senior Fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, and I hope you'll come back and join us as we continue this discussion over the weeks and months.
Thanks for having us.
Trust me on this one. We spent our prom nights reading the Constitution.
Yeah!
So we've got a message for Governor Snyder. When it comes to honesty, integrity, and democracy, Governor Snyder, you're no tough nerd.
No.
You're nothing but one big bully.
Yeah!
This summer, hundreds of young union members from across the country have gathered together in Detroit, Michigan, ground zero for recent anti-union attacks.
This group of AFSCME members calls themselves the Next Wave, and is made up of new and young union members who have joined together to stand up for the rights of working people across the country.
There's no security for us. We'll go year by year sometimes not knowing if we're going to be in a budget or not. You know, we've lost so many friends to budget cuts, to layoffs, to privatization, to outsourcing. It's insane.
Unions, I think, are the only voice for the middle class, for working people. No one else is really advocating on their behalf.
And when it comes to implementing, for example, deferred action, when it comes to fighting for more union, pro-union laws, right? We need each other to be advocating for each other, with each other.
The governor's hand-picked emergency manager has free rein to privatize any services he chooses, slash pensions, disregard our contract, and trample our rights.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio in New York, I'm Don DeBar. Thanks for listening.